Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We only have one case on our 130 docket, and we do appreciate your patience with us today. We have one case, Beckstrand versus State of Texas, cause number 213-399-CR. If the clerk will announce who's checked in as far as oral argument today, that would be helpful. All right, Mr. Salvant.
Thank you, Mr. Court. I just also wanted to introduce my co-counsel, Dean Patrick Anderson. Helped me out quite a bit. Happy to have him here with me. Today we're here to talk about the Beckstrand case. What I would like to do is I will rely on my brief, but also specifically on the point of error number two. On the issue of the legal sufficiency or the insufficiency of the evidence in this situation. This case reminds me of a word song that starts off something from nothing means nothing. That's kind of what we have in this situation. When we talk about the legal sufficiency of this type of case, it is a stalking case. And the statute states that a person commits an offense in person on more than one occasion in pursuit of the same scheme or course of conduct that is directed specifically at another person, knowingly engages in conduct that the actor knows or reasonably should know the other person will regard as threatening bodily injury or death for the other person, or causes the other person to place in fear of bodily injury or death, and would cause a reasonable person to fear bodily injury or death for himself or herself. Throughout this whole case, there's not one inference where my client, Mr. Beckstrand, makes any type of threatening comments to the victim. There's not one inference or instance when my client makes any threatening gestures. There just isn't anything there that a reasonable person could even consider or infer as being threatening his bodily injury or death. So many things came out in this trial that related inferences and tried to stretch some sort of a threat. For instance, my client possessed or he owned a weapon. And the state tries to say, well, simply by owning a weapon, that would infer some sort of a threat towards someone. And that's just not the case. I mean, especially here in Texas, just about everybody owns a weapon. There was some testimony that the victim heard someone yelling, "I'm going to kill you." Keep in mind that my client was not in the vicinity. I believe the victim was upstairs. My client was in a garage when she heard these things. The state refers to some letters that my client sent. These letters were sent a year after this incident occurred. There were 16 letters over, I believe it's about an 8-month, or maybe it's like a 6-month time period. And we just don't believe that there was never any evidence at trial to indicate that my client was stalking this victim. We'll also move to the error in point three. Everything about that situation is hearsay. Just straight from the transcript and we put in the brief, you have a situation where the probation officer is called to testify as to what a different probationer had heard from my client. I don't know how much clearer that can be for hearsay. It was definitely a statement, an out-of-court statement offered for the truth of the matter asserted. The error was preserved. The trial attorney did make the objection outside the presence of the jury, and I believe it was Rule 103A1, which shows that the trial attorney did preserve that, or he did make that objection. It was a timely objection. And the rest of our arguments will stand on our brief.
What do you say about the argument of the state that reversible error no longer requires reversal and rendering, but instead reverse and remand for the state to get another bite at the apple?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that for
me? Yeah, the state argues that insufficient evidence no longer requires that we reverse and render, but that we reverse and remand to give the state another bite at the apple. Do you have an answer to that, or should we just ask the state about it?
Well, I do have an answer, and can my co-counsel respond to that question?
Sure, that's fine.
What the state relies on when they're saying there's a separate state law sufficiency standard that would require reverse and remand rather than reverse and rendering, that only applies in a variance case in which the state proved that the defendant committed the charged offense, but he didn't commit it as charged in the indictment. And that's not what we have here. This is a case where the state wholly failed to prove that the defendant committed the offense of stalking as defined by the applicable statute.
Thank you.
No.
So what does the state contend under your understanding constituted the stalking? Was it the going within the prohibited areas, going to the children's courtyard, or was it yelling, I'm going to kill you, or having a gun in the, was it a truck or a car? I don't remember. A truck. I mean, what's your understanding of what they think constitutes stalking?
Well, honestly, I really don't think that they really thought that one of those individual aspects constituted stalking. I think that's why they piled them all together to try to make so many inferences of a stalking to secure a guilty verdict, which they did. And I guess what I'm getting at is, simply by going to the children's school, there were never any threats. All he did was walk in the school and said, are my kids okay? And this was all done at the door. Once the lady says, yes, they are, he left. He went about his business. The fact of the weapon being in the car, it seems very clear to me that if there was some sort of threat of bodily injury, he had gone into the house, he would have taken the gun with him. I mean, he left it there. When the police came, he told them that he had a weapon that was in the car, and he told them to secure the weapon even. So I think that the state tried to grab all of these, bunch all of these inferences up in order to almost scare the jury into some sort of a stalking conviction. And, you know, one thing that is also, I think, is an important point that is kind of overlooked is that we're talking about a situation where these were bond conditions. I think the state's argument would carry a little more weight if this was some sort of a protective order. I mean, people go against protective orders because they feel like they need to be protected, their life is in danger, their children's lives are in danger. These were just simply bond conditions. These were just conditions that a judge put down at the time that my client made bond. And I think that's a huge point in a sufficiency case like this.
Now, you didn't try this case, is that right?
I did not try this case.
Do you know whether the constitutionality of the statute has been challenged at any point? In this case, not generally, because the portions of the statute have been declared unconstitutional. But was it ever challenged in this case?
I don't believe there was in this case.
I think it's been amended since then.
Yeah, I didn't know which statute it was under or whether it's...
But I don't know what's I have a question about the acts that the state relied upon. Was the original breaking and entering of the house also used as one of the acts constituting stalking? In this case, was the state allowed to go into that as a prior conviction, or did, okay, question, that's it.
I think what you're getting at, I think that what the state was trying to say was that the breaking and entering of the house, coupled with the things that went on in the stalking case, that was going to be the same scheme or course of conduct. I think that's where they were trying to make the connection, stating that I'm breaking into the house, and then later, as he wrote letters and went to the school, that some kind of way that was the same theme or I'm sorry scheme or course of conduct, and we would also disagree with that.
All right, thank you, Mr. Savant and Mr. Arrington. Ms. Wesley.
May it please the court, my name is Kimberly Wesley, and I will be representing the state of Texas. On the first point regarding recusal, just very briefly, Your Honor, the state would like to point this court to the motion to strike appellate's exhibits A and B, in which appellate sought to bring before this court's attention excerpts from the burglary trial that were not before Judge Walker during the recusal hearing, as well as part of the appellate record. In part in making his argument regarding Judge Gonzalez's the suitability of recusing him from this trial. So to redirect the court's attention to the state's motion to strike, which we filed back in April of this year, which has not yet been ruled upon. Moving on to the sufficiency argument, the correct analysis in reviewing sufficiency is what the state introduced, not what, as appellant suggests, the state did not introduce. In a stalking case, the stalking in this case was through the appellant's conduct. The appellant does not have to come out and say, I'm going to harm you, I'm going to kill you.
But what constitutes stalking in the state's, what's the state's position? What constitutes stalking in this case?
The state alleged a course of conduct that began with the appellant's conduct during the burglary, not necessarily retrying him for that offense, but the facts of that case were he claimed that he was going to retrieve his property. However, on the way out, he decided to hang a photo of himself and the victim, an engagement photo, and that established a course of conduct that continued throughout this entire case. The suggestion that he and the victim were together and that they will always be together, his refusal to recognize the divorce, as evidenced by that first act in rehanging the engagement photo, moving on to the letters that he wrote, where he explicitly said, we are not divorced under the eyes of God, we are only divorced in the legal sense.
The whole Catholic Church says that.
And yes, but that evidence is his refusal to recognize the fact that they were no longer together.
And that's stalking.
That is establishing a course of conduct that intimidates and terrifies the victim. When coupled with his reminders to her in writing those letters that he was going to be released pretty soon and that they still had a personal relationship, he deserved a companion, he deserved her as his companion, he still needed her love, and oh, by the way, I'll see you in a couple of months. So stalking isn't necessarily someone outside your window. Stalking is a crime that seeks to assert control over the victim through a course of conduct. It can be verbal, it can be through letters. Not only did this man refuse to recognize their separation, he also threatened her livelihood. He threatened to have her he threatened to report crimes to her employer, not only her employer, but also to the Department of Justice. He also threatened that if she did not come to see him in jail at a specific time, he would direct his mother to send these letters that he had written to the two authorities. Now, whether or not there was any basis for these claims on his part is beside the point, but it's just another evidence of him trying to assert control and dominance over the victim.
Is blackmail the same as stalking?
Yes, it can be, because it creates a sense of intimidation. It terrifies the victim.
Is there a case law that says blackmail is the same as stalking?
Well, specifically, Your Honor, the state can research that, but it's really not the... It's the behavior itself. It's the intent on the part of the defendant. And in this case, he established his intent to put the victim in fear, to intimidate her. He even specifically states in one of the letters that whenever she needs to find a better way to assert her dominance over him when she feels threatened by him. So he himself acknowledges that he is engaged in conduct that has caused her to feel threatened. So he's aware of the consequences of his actions in this matter. So he himself, in his own writing, says, you need to find a better way to assert your dominance over me when you feel threatened by me. And that's in the record.
And were all those letters were admitted into evidence, is that correct?
Yes, all those letters were written into evidence. And Your Honor, I didn't write the brief in this case, but in getting up to speed on this case, it took me 6 hours to read those letters. That gives you a sense of the sheer volume of the letters that he sent to the victim in the time leading up to his anticipated release.
And so those letters were written while he was held in jail on the underlying burglary, is that?
Not necessarily an underlying, because that's not related to this offense in that sense, but definitely while he was in jail for burglarizing her home, for vandalizing her home after they had agreed that she would have full possession of the home. Yes, he wrote these letters in that time period, and specifically in the 3 months from September to January when he anticipated his release, the volume of letters grew and grew and grew. And not only were they directed at her, but they were also directed at their children, specifically his adopted son, her biological son, in which he notes that he and the child were linked together in the womb and that they would always be connected and that essentially, her son would always be a part of him. Now, that's directed at the son. However, that creates a reasonable fear in her mind. Just the sheer irrational.
I love my stepson.
So we are linked together in the womb. You are my twin who died in my mother's womb before I was born. And we will be connected forever because of this sense that you were a part of me in my mother's womb. I mean, that's just completely irrational, Your Honor.
Some people would say it's Shakespearean.
Shakespearean nonetheless. It's still something that, in her mind, she testified to the fact that she was placed in fear of this. The prosecutor, during the trial, pointed out to the jury and to the court the fear that was on her face in saying, I noticed that when I mentioned this letter, when we talk about this letter, your eyes are widening. So the jury was able to see the fact that she was in fear based on the content of that letter. So this is what the jury saw, not necessarily what, we can call it Shakespearean, we can have our own assessment, but what the jury saw was the fear that she was placed under when she saw that letter. And you couple that with the fact that he has already broken into the home, he has already been sending her numerous letters to the effect that we will always be together. I am your king. You are my queen. You need to learn how to submit to me. I want to taste your fruits again. He is not letting her go. Stalking is obsessive love, veering from obsessive hate, which is evidenced quite clearly in these letters. In one instance, he's referring to her as his loving wife. And in the next instance, he's saying that he cannot believe how evil and bitter and cold she is. He's cursing her out in the letters. And sure, yes, this was a situation where it was a contentious separation, divorce. However, regarding the underlying crime of stalking, this is what we're looking for, is this obsessive focus on the victim, these obsessive emotions, coupled with aggressive conduct, which we saw with the burglary, coupled with his refusal to honor the wishes of the court. So yes, these were just bond conditions, but his complete disregard of these bond conditions evidences his refusal to recognize boundaries at any level, boundaries set by her, boundaries set by the court. And that is what stalking is about, a refusal to acknowledge boundaries.
And what are the elements of stalking?
Elements of stalking are a scheme of course of conduct that is directed at a victim, and that the defendant or reasonably knows that these will place the victim in fear of death or bodily harm, and that the victim is in fear of that, and that a reasonable person would be in fear of death or bodily harm. And that's what the state proved in this case, you know, dating back from the burglary that occurred in July of 2011.
And did the evidence show when he acquired this firearm that was found in his truck?
There was testimony from, if I recall correctly, a probation, or from a pawnbroker, I think, as to when he purchased the gun, that he did later inform police was in his truck. Yes. So as far as the, you know, really just to reiterate, stalking, you know, in this case, you have to look at the totality of the evidence that was introduced by the state and what was before the jury. It's not just about a burglary. It's not just about a separation. It's about a defendant engaging in a continued scheme or course of conduct that's designed to intimidate, terrify the victim, and whether a reasonable person would indeed be placed in fear by this scheme or course of conduct.
And specifically, what did appellant do intentionally or knowingly to cause the complainant to fear? Is it just bodily injury or death or serious?
It's death or bodily injury.
Okay. What specifically did he do to intentionally cause her to fear death or bodily injury?
Well, he broke into their home.
No, but did he say he was going to harm her? Did he point a gun at her? Did he threaten her with his fists? Or
he doesn't have to do it directly at the victim. He can do it indirectly. He can do it through contacting her family member. I mean, in conjunction with that burglary, I mean, he did assault a family member. I mean, he did assault a family member. He did say, "I'm going to kill you," and that's something that she knew. She didn't have to. She knew, even if it wasn't necessarily from him, she knew that at the time that he had threatened to kill her. She didn't have to hear that. She knew that. She knew that through the letters where, you know, someone says, "I'm going to kill you. I've broken into your home. I know this. I'm calling you evil. I'm blaming you for all of my troubles."
And he said in his letters, "I'm going to kill you."
No, he said that. That was what was overheard when he burglarized the home.
Who was he saying it to?
It just was something that I think was something that the brother heard, or, you know, from, if I recall correctly. But it's definitely in the record that she, based on something that she heard, that he said that he wanted to kill her, not necessarily from others. So it's in her mind.
So other people told her that he wanted to kill her?
Yes. And he, you know, and then, you know, someone breaks into your home, and then someone in letters tells you that if you work with them, they'll protect you. Well, what is he going to protect her from? This is a letter that he wrote her shortly before his anticipated release. If you work with me, I'll protect you. Pretty soon, pretty soon a judge, a prosecutor, a sheriff is going to be really angry with me. Well, angry with me for what? I mean, this is continued threatening and intimidation of this victim. These are volumes and volumes and volumes of letters. You know, the jury was able to infer the fact that he was, the world was able to link these actions and these written letters from him in order to reach a reasonable conclusion that was his intent. His intent was to create fear in this victim of death or bodily harm if we're not together We're going to be together regardless. You know, he's even at one point he says regarding the children, you know, I will be with you soon if your mother, basically, if whether you're pretty much, I hope your mother decides to be with us too, but I will be with you soon. I mean, he is attacking her livelihood. He is making veiled threats regarding her children. He is attacking her character. He is attacking her family.
Attacking her character, her livelihood, that's not stalking.
It is creating a sense of intimidation and control and dominance over the victim.
Are those elements of stalking? I thought it was bodily injury or death.
Fear of.
Right.
Fear of.
But not loss of livelihood or, I mean.
Right, but that's, you're coupling with the fact that, you know, this, all, he's directing these very disturbing communications to her. And, you know, at some point, you know, we have to, you know, kind of read between the lines of what's in the record, as the jury did, as a reasonable person would have done, I mean, and say, you know, this, and understand that despite the fact that she's not contacted him during the entire time that he's been in jail, he's still obsessed with her. And he's pretty much told her, I will see you on January 4th, 2013. You know, I'm coming to see you. We deserve a relationship together. I deserve a loving companion, and I need your love. And, you know, Your Honor, at some point, you know, if we always expect a defendant to admit what they're planning on doing, I mean, no one would be in jail. I mean, that's pretty much what circumstantial evidence is about and what the jury being able to draw inferences from the evidence is about. And, you know, that's what they did in this case in deciding that he was guilty of stalking. And that's the state's position, Your Honor, respectfully.
The January 4th date, was that to be when he was released on parole?
It was his anticipated release on parole.
He was then indicted for the stalking offense on January the 5th? I believe some brief I read said that.
Honestly, Your Honor, I had to recheck the dates, but yes, it was thereabouts that he was indicted for stalking, yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Moving on to...
Your time is up.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Ms. Wesley. Mr. Salvant? But doesn't, in your mind, doesn't it create more of a likelihood that if you hear somebody threatening the life of someone else, that maybe if they say something aggressively towards you, that there might be more truth to that or a real reason to be concerned?
In certain situations, I can see how that could be true, but first we would have to determine who even said that. It may have been her brother who came and saw him and was startled by seeing him in the garage and said, I'm going to kill you. I don't necessarily think that would make Ms. Beckstrand go away. But there's just no evidence of that. I mean, that's the whole problem with this case. There is no evidence that my client did any of this. And I also take exception with the state saying that certainly that the three of you should have to read between the lines. I mean, I think the law is very clear. It would have to be some sort of an action that would cause a reasonable person to fear bodily injury or death to him or herself. And I don't think they've given one example of how anything that my client did or said would make a reasonable person feel like they were in fear of death or bodily injury. I mean, we're talking about some letters that were sent, not one of them threatening Ms. Bestrand. We're talking about hanging a photo, which no one knows who did that, but if you want to infer that since he broke in, he hung a photo, for the life of me, I don't know how anyone would could infer that that would be some sort of not going to infer, but that would cause a reasonable person to fear death or bodily injury. And you know, the state also stated that stalking is an obsessive love. That's just not true. I mean, it's just not in the statute anywhere that it says that if you're obsessing over someone, that is stalking. I think it's very clear that an individual, to be convicted of stalking, the state would have to prove that a reasonable person would fear death or bodily injury, and there just has not been anything, not one piece of evidence to show that that my client ever inferred that he was going to injure this person. I think it's just the opposite. He was still in love with her, and he kept stating that he loved her and that he, you know, that he, in his eyes, they were still married, and, you know, in God's eyes or what have you. I mean, never once did he say, I was going to come hurt you, I was going to come hurt the kids. He did not confront her with a weapon, even when he had one in a different location. I just don't understand how there could be any inference of doing any type of harm to this individual.
What about the fact that he asked the trial judge for his weapon back when he knew he was going to be getting out of jail?
Well, I still don't see how that would be reckoned with. Someone asking for their weapon, and I can't speak for him about if his knowledge of the law of being a convicted felon, he shouldn't have a weapon or not. He's just basically asking for his property back. I don't see how someone asking for a property back would make a reasonable person infer that they're about to be harmed without some other indication. And one other thing that I'd also like to point out from the statute is that a person commits an offense with a person on more than one occasion. So it would have been on a few occasions that he would have made some sort of a threatening remark to make someone feel that they were in danger. And if we're talking about him stating one time I'm going to kill you, and we don't know who actually said that, or who it was directed to, I think the law is so clear that it has to be more than just one occasion.
All right, Mr. Salvant, thank you for your arguments today. And Mr. Arrington and Ms. Wesley, we appreciate your arguments. We appreciate also the briefing that the parties did for their presentation today. Your case is now submitted, and that being our only docket item for this afternoon, we will adjourn court.